Words on Water.
Hi, welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. This is the host, Travis Loop. A while ago, WEF Executive Director Eileen O'Neill suggested that I should sit down and have a podcast with this guest, someone that has a very interesting background and career in water and some great perspective. So I'm joined by Janelle Armstrong. She's with the Thrasher Group. She's a licensed professional engineer in Texas, New Mexico, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and also recently became a project management professional. She's been designing, managing water and wastewater projects for 20 years. So, Janelle, I'm glad after many months of interaction on social media, going back on tweets and so forth, that we finally meet in person.
Yeah, it's wonderful to meet you. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, I'm looking
very
forward.
Excited about this.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to having a conversation. So one of the things we talked about before we started recording is that you went to the U.S. Naval Academy. That's in Annapolis, Maryland. And I mentioned that I'm a Maryland native, and I lived in Annapolis for nine years. So I have an affinity for the Naval Academy. It's an awesome place. You majored in ocean engineering there, and I'm just kind of wondering how your time at the Naval Academy, which is a water ocean-focused branch of the military and majoring in ocean engineering, how that shaped you as a water leader and a water professional.
Well, it was, I'll tell you, it was a rude awakening when I went to the Naval Academy.
Uh-huh.
I came from high school, of course, and things were pretty easy. You know, it was kind of put minimal effort in, did great, you know, kind of big fish in a small pond,
yeah.
And that whole thing. And going to the academy was instantly teaching you about humility, because you fail. You know, you fail daily, because they always load you up with things that you're not going to succeed. It's intended to be that way. I mean, perspective of a 17-year-old, I didn't get that. But now I'm looking back, I understand.
That was intentional.
It was intentional.
Yeah.
And it was really the first time I was introduced to humility and really servant leadership, if you could say it that way. You know, leadership before that, I'm kind of a natural leader, I kind of take control. But leadership was kind of being the loudest person in the room. You know, sometimes in high school, that's
right.
How it works. But that's not how it is there, and that's not always the most effective. So, you know, it was really great to go there and kind of learn about failure, about coming out of failure, and about how to build yourself up. So that was something I absolutely learned there. And then I spent time while there on the USS Kitty Hawk, and as well as at a weapons test squadron in Point Lagoon, California. And that's great. I got to fly on the trainer versions of all the aircraft that the Navy had at the time, the F-14, the F-18, and the F-4 Phantom, which my favorite. So
okay.
I got to fly there, and then on the Kitty Hawk.
Is that an aircraft carrier?
It is.
Okay, that's what I thought.
It's a conventional aircraft carrier.
Okay.
We were in North Island at the time, which is San Diego area. And the Navy decided that they wanted to integrate the Kitty Hawk. It wasn't integrated before, at least on the enlisted level. So they decided to send four midshipmen, four of us from the Academy, who aren't officers yet. We're not really enlisted. We're kind of in that no man's land.
Mm-hmm.
But they sent four of us, women, to integrate the ship, trial run type thing. Let's see how they do.
You know? Wow.
So we were in a 22-person berthing for four of us. You know, it was crazy. It was something very different. But
that's interesting that they would, you know, turn to midshipmen, you know, to throw into that trial situation, right?
I think it's, you know, we're kind of that in between. We weren't going to be seen as officers on the ship. We weren't really side by side enlisted. I think they were just trying to see how people would react
wow.
to it. And being, you know, I think I was maybe 18 at the time. You know, it was a different experience. It was fully loaded. There's probably about 5,000 people on the ship, so it's not like we weren't obvious. You know, there have been female officers on board, pilots, other. You know, there have been females on board, but not in that level, not
okay.
that thing. So it was really it kind of, I always say, it set me up, because when I joined the water industry, it was male-dominated field. It very much was a male-dominated field. This is 20 years ago, and it is so much different now. it's not probably where I would love to see it, you know, but it is so much different. I mean, I joked after the opening session here, I went to the restroom afterwards, it was actually full.
Oh,
wow. It was the first time here that that has ever happened, because there's actually so many women. I saw there was an all-women team competing in the Ops Challenge today.
Yeah, that's awesome. It was incredible.
And I have a lot of young, amazing women engineers and women technicians that work for me now that, you know, it's a different scenario now. But for me, like, that helped me learning how to deal with it in the Navy, which was fairly male-dominated, and the Academy was as well. There was, I think, 10% women at the time. And this is, you know, 17 years after they had accepted women. So it was still 10%. It is significantly different now.
Yeah.
The percentages are very much changed.
Just like they have in the water sector. Yeah.
But I thought that really prepared me for kind of what you face a little bit.
And could you elaborate? So that's a great lesson. But you also mentioned, you know, this phrase servant leadership. What does that mean?
Servant leadership to me, like I mentioned earlier, you mentioned I was a student of leadership. And what that is kind of is leadership changes. Leadership has been evolving. It's almost its own topic nowadays. There's so much more information than even than there was when I was at the Academy, and we take leadership classes, but there is so much more to it now. And we used to think you were a style of leadership. Like, each person was this style. You know, you take a test and they tell you you're a pace-setting leader, you know. Or some other, there's lots of styles of leadership out there. Each book has their own grouping. But that's not really the case. And servant leadership means that your leadership is serving the people that you're trying to lead. Serving them doesn't come in one size fits all. It's adjusting. It's knowing what's right for the people that you're serving and you're leading, knowing what's right for the situation at hand. And by studying leadership and understanding it, you can apply kind of the right tool for the situation. Now, I initially really struggled with that because I felt like it wasn't true to myself. Like, am I being fake or, you know, not acting the way I want to act? And so I kind of had to wrestle with that for a while. You know, I had to figure out what does that mean. And what it came down to is, once you have your core values, like, if you have your core values, as long as you're acting within those core values, changing the way you're responding to a person or interacting with a person to best suit them is what servant leadership is. It's not forcing you on them. It's becoming...
And it's not being untrue to yourself.
Right, as long as you stick with your core values. So, you know, I had to go through a process where I established, okay, what are my core values? And, you know, I established that, and then I can act in a way that, as long as it's true to me, you can adjust your style to the situation.
You clearly are a student of leadership and women in leadership. And I just wonder if you can elaborate a little bit about why it's so important to you, but also why it's important or useful to study leadership and be in the water sector. Like, how does that...
I started studying leadership. I was just very interested in it. But I think I continue doing it because, to some extent, it gives me credibility. And it gives me a chance to explain it and understand it. You know, explain it to others so they can understand it. And women in leadership is something we're striving for. I mean, I think as you see more women in our industry, without that... I just think the more different perspectives that come together, the better the solution. So whether it be men and women or minorities and non-minorities or whatever the case may be, people who went to different, have different education, people come at it from different points of view. The more collaboration you have with different types of people, the end result is always better. And so part of having women in leadership is to try to get those voices heard so that our end result is better.
I know that... A lot of times when people talk about trying to increase the diversity of the workforce in the water sector, you know, the question is, well, why exactly? Why should we be more representative of the general population?
Right.
And I think those are some of the reasons. It's because you're just going to get that diversity brings a diversity of experience and diversity of knowledge and viewpoint, and it just is beneficial.
When we solve complex problems in this world, I mean, in our industry, we have a lot of, between climate change and the various things happening out there, we have complex problems to solve. Why would you leave out a whole group of opinions and ideas and different approaches to those solutions? So to me, it doesn't make sense to not incorporate and include others.
Mm-hmm.
So I as we try to reach out and make sure my own field that we're including others.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of leadership, I know that one of the leaders that you've liked some quotes from and leadership style is this Rear Admiral Grace Hopper. I guess she was around a while ago, maybe 50, 60 years ago.
I believe so. Okay. I don't,
Yeah. And so you shared a quote from her, and it says, "Humans are allergic to change. They love to say, 'We've always done it this way.' I try to fight that." And the part that really jumped out at me is she says, "That's why I have a clock on my wall that runs counterclockwise." Yeah, so.
I love that. There's something to be said with approaching a situation differently, with looking at it differently. And I love this so much, I actually purchased and put a clock in my own office that runs counterclockwise, which always gets people's attention. Because they look closely and they're like, "Wait, what time is it?"
Yeah.
So the idea is, just because the convention said a clock needs to run, you know, run clockwise, why? Why does it have to, you know? So the idea is to shake your mind up, to look at it differently, and to be able to experience new things and new ideas. So it just kind of gets people changing their mindset. It opens their eyes a little bit, and I enjoy doing that.
Yeah, so it's not the numbers actually go the different way also,
yeah,
right? So
yeah,
like the 1, 2, 3 on the left, and it goes that way.
Yeah.
It's hard even to make your mind visualize that because you're so used to it.
And it's funny because now that I've had it for a couple of years, I can read it instantly. And I have it directly above, I have a water meter clock in my office, an old water meter cover. We've turned it into a clock.
Yeah.
And they're right next to each other. So you can see them both. And instantly, you can read it now. As soon as you, I mean, your mind will adjust, right?
So
it's pretty funny. But to me, there's nothing worse than, you know, a person or someone, or even if I'm in this situation where you're frustrated with something going on, you're wanting to complain, and that doesn't help, but yet you're not open to new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
If you're frustrated with something the way it is, you've got to at least consider new ideas. That's one of my number one things. Like,
yeah.
I don't understand why you would not want to change if you don't like the way it is.
Sure, absolutely.
But we do. I mean, to some extent, especially as an engineer, our industry, civil engineers in general, are, you know, I'm a civil engineer as well, and master's my environmental, but, you know, civil engineering is where I initially got ocean engineering, civil engineering.
Okay.
And we tend to be a little stuck in our ways at time. You know, it's one of the oldest engineering professions in the world.
This is how you build this system, or et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if it worked for you, why would you change it?
Right.
I agree with that, but I kind of always look at the, if it's good, it could be great, you know, that whole transition.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it doesn't mean since something's good, it can't be better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a continuous learning, continuous improvement. It's one of, you know, my core values is wanting to ensure that continuous learning.
Mm, I like that. Shifting gears a little bit, but staying connected to the military angle, you know, we know the water sector is really in need of more talent, both, you know, numbers of people and also people that can handle how the water sector is changing and the different types of jobs and all that. You know, I think that one source is veterans and trying to bring more veterans into the water workforce. And so I'm just curious as to your thoughts on why veterans make outstanding employees and why they'd be, you know, why they are a great fit for the water sector.
I think that's excellent. I come from a family of veterans. Both my husband's side and my side, and there's a lot of veterans in our family. And I really think they are naturally to fit in the water industry. And there's a couple reasons why.
Okay.
Their skill set and their approach to problem solving aligns very closely with what we do in the water industry. So veterans are taught to follow like SOPs, standard operating procedures. But they're taught to have the leadership and the vision to be able to adjust that based on actual field conditions. I mean, that's something that's inherently taught in that industry.
Mm.
And that's exactly what we do in our industry. Yes, we should operate, say, a plant. For example, operating a plant. You would follow your standard operating procedures. But plants are, you know, unique things. They respond differently. They're biological. They're, you know, so you have to have the confidence and the ability to think through, okay, this is what's happening, how am I going to respond? And that's naturally suited to what veterans do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be honest, they're not afraid of hard work, right? you do, as a veteran, you know, in the military, you typically do a lot of things that are challenging, you know, quote, you know, embrace the suck, you know, kind of like, you know, embrace that it's not that fun sometimes. You get it done and you're proud of what you do. I also think veterans in general are kind of understand their why, their purpose, and they're called to kind of a bigger, to serve others. Mm. And that's why they probably join the military. And I think the water industry has that. Like the opening session yesterday would be a hero, right?
Yeah.
The water industry is serving so many people. And we're the, you know, I call operators the first responders of the environment. You know?
Yeah.
They are the ones that are like the front line protecting, especially in both sides, the water operators and the wastewater treatment plant operators. They're kind of right there on the front lines, the collection system folks, of protecting our environment, which is then protecting human health.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a unique thing. But I think veterans are suited for that.
Yeah, they like to have a mission that's beyond themselves. Yeah.
So, and I think this could provide that and allow them to transition easier, because it's not always an easy transition getting out of the military, especially if you've been in for a while. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of quote-unquote real-world jobs, you know, that aren't the same, aren't as mission-driven as our industry is. I think it's a unique fit that we're trying to reach out and really have a pipeline for people coming out of the military to think and consider water industry jobs.
Yeah. The other thing is there's, you know, so many different types of jobs in the water sector, in the water industry. And so, you know, veterans that are coming out of their different fields in the military, there's a lot of different choices, places that they could plug into the water sector.
I didn't even mention that. You're right. There's really high-tech jobs in the military, too. The military is completely transitioned from more, you know, hard labor type jobs to really high tech, cutting edge, and we need that in our industry. You know, if you go down and look at this equipment on the floor, it is cutting edge stuff, and everything has computer built in. You know, you have pumps with controls built in on them that control them. It's next level stuff, and you know, the folks coming out of the military are used to that. They're comfortable with that.
Yeah,
they're comfortable with big equipment and, you know, exciting stuff.
Yeah. I did do sat down for a podcast last year with someone who is in the Massachusetts National Guard, and I think her name is Brandy Madden. She was involved with going in before even some operation could occur to set up the water, right? Like even if you're going to deploy a unit somewhere or something, you've got to have water there for them first.
Yeah, you have to just like. Anyway, you have to have infrastructure before you can send people there.
So, yeah.
There's a lot of people that go in and actually work in the water industry in the military.
Yeah.
Before I moved to Charleston, West Virginia, I was in El Paso, Texas. And we did a lot of support for Fort Bliss there in El Paso.
Okay.
And, you know, the military and water does intersect a lot. So it's a natural transition, I think. And we could really optimize how many folks are coming out of that industry into ours.
So you mentioned Charleston, West Virginia. That's where you live now. And I just wanted to ask about your experience as a citizen in Charleston in 2014 when they had the crisis there with a large quantity of MCHM that was released into the Elk River. It leaked out of a storage tank, I think it was a facility there right on the river, and no one knew about it for a while. And I think the water treatment plant thought that the process would handle it and eliminate that, but it didn't. And I know it was definitely big national news. A lot of people couldn't drink water for a while.
A couple weeks.
Yes. Yeah. And so what was it like being right there in the middle of that crisis? And
well, it was kind of funny because water rarely has center stage, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people don't talk about water.
Unless something's wrong.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, everyone wanted my opinion on something, which was surprising. We've never spoke about water in my whole life with these people. But
yeah.
It was very challenging, and you don't really think about it. We really are spoiled to some extent that we just turn on a faucet and know we have safe drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
But when you don't, it kind of puts it in a whole different world. Now, we were really fortunate because we still have water.
Mm.
You know, we were told not to drink it.
Okay.
It wasn't safe to drink. So we could flush toilets. We could, you know, we were told not to bathe in it and not to drink it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I you know, I bathed in it. I took showers, but I did not do it for my children. Each weekend we went away, we got them.
Okay.
You know, I wasn't sure. Like, yeah. For me, I felt like I could take the risk. I'm an adult, but
right,
I wasn't willing to do it with my kiddos.
Kids are more sensitive to,
And they were younger. That was 4 years ago, so they were, you know, they were real little.
Then. Yeah.
And I just, so, you know, we went away outside of the area to kind of make sure they get baths and get clean. But
you find out just like, wow, if you can flush the toilet, then, and you can get drinking water, some point, bottled water in a situation like, okay.
You can kind of survive.
But if you can't flush that toilet,
right, that's then a whole other issue.
That's a whole
other issue. But I was actually traveling for work, which I do a lot, so I was a couple hours north of the area when it occurred, and I heard about it.
Mm.
So you know how those things go. As soon as you hear about something like that, bottled water is gone, right? It's off all the shelves.
Right.
So I stopped at a Sam's Club further north, filled my whole truck up with bottled water, brought it back to the office. Gave some out, took some home, you know, so that we'd at least have something.
And yeah.
The only time I will say I actively bought that much bottled water. I try to avoid that, right?
Of course. Yeah.
But sometimes,
that's
an
emergency.
Yeah. So I did do that, which I think was helpful. But I guess something that came to my mind in the communication with your customers during a situation like this is beyond critical.
Mm.
And when there is no communication, when there's a void of communication, it's always negativity that fills it.
Mm.
I think I was reading a book recently by John Gordon, and he said something like that, you know, where the void of communication will always be filled with negativity or something.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's exactly what happened during this. Because,
wow.
Don't get me wrong, there was an attempt to communicate, but it was just, with today's world, you know, you want instant communication.
Oh, right.
It took a very long time for them to figure out what we were going to do about it.
Yeah.
You know, well, how are we going to solve this? And I would say, overall, they did a good job trying to contain it and understand it. My only complaint, my lesson learned would be, one, communicate as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you don't know, you say you don't know.
Right.
You know?
And what you're trying to figure out.
And what you're trying to figure out, where you're going, when you think you might know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even when you don't have something to communicate that.
Mm-hmm.
But then the way we got rid of it within the system is we ended up flushing. Every person had to flush their home. So they took the pressure zones and they kind of went out from the center, and each person had to flush their home from the chemical. And the chemical is used in the coal industry a lot. It's not really super toxic, but I'll tell you, it's super odorous.
Yeah, licorice smell.
It smells
right?
like black licorice.
Yeah.
And I don't like black licorice. I really don't like it.
Not many people do. Why do they still make that stuff?
Terrible. And so when you're flushing it through your home, It's overwhelmingly odorous.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, oh. So that part I would have said, let's not do it that way. And I understand they had to, you know, there were reasons they probably did, but those weren't always fully communicated either. But flushing it all through our homes, I think that could have been done a little bit differently.
That's
the only lesson learned. And communication.
Yeah.
Getting out there and communicating, we don't know, but this is what we're trying to figure out.
Well, you keep setting me up with great segues here. So speaking of pipes and flushing and communication, you kind of came up with the hashtag wipes clogged pipes.
I did. I'll tell you, wipes are a nightmare for our industry, for the wastewater industry. I mean, folks that work out in the field, whether you call them wipes or rags or whatever you want to refer to them as, they are a nightmare. And I was out in El Paso at the time, and we were just finishing up the construction of a pump station. It was going to eventually replace a smaller pump station.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a call at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, from the operator. I was like, we need to turn the new one on now. We hadn't tested. We haven't done anything yet. I'm like, okay, you need to come here now.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I got in my car and went, and the pumps, the old one had failed. Both pumps had failed.
Mm.
So we went ahead and energized the new system, and really never did a lot of, a little bit of clean water testing, but really not much. And we just said, well, it's going to be what it's going to be.
Yeah.
And we went ahead and turned it on, and because it was filling up. The wet well's filling up. It was starting to back up. It was going to be in people's homes pretty quickly.
Wow.
Here. So we were like, there's not too many critical times in our industry for an engineer, but this was one of them. So we went out, we got it running, and that was fine. But then they started, of course, taking the old pumps out of the old station, and they were just packed full of the wipes mixed with the grease, mixed with, I think they could build homes out of that material if they compacted it into bricks.
The Fatberg material.
Oh, my golly. It's like the strongest material known to man, I think. And it was packed full of them. And, you know, it just came to me that we can't do this. You know, we cannot continue to allow people to flush them. Because what happened, as soon as you came out with flushable wipes,
right,
everyone decided everything was now flushable, you know? And I feel like it's gotten better. I feel like the word is now out there, and people are distinguishing between, like, your baby wipes versus your, you know, your actual, the ones they call flushable, and I'm using quotes, you know, flushable.
Right, but, right. There's still a lot of work on trying to determine what the standards should be for something to be called flushable.
Yes, and the non-woven industry, or, you know, trying to figure out what should be considered flushable, and in my mind, trash them all, you know, don't flush any of them.
Right, right.
We have the, you know, well, you know it too, the three P's. You
got to
do three P's.
Yeah, exactly.
I say this all the time. I stand up in homeowners meetings and tell everyone, look, you need to know this is what we don't need in our system.
It's a toilet, not a trash can.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they laugh at me. People, you know, I don't mind. That's okay.
But you did this hashtag and it kind of took fire. And
it did. And San Antonio Water System kind of adopted it. And it's on all of their stuff. And it was super cute. They sent me a little medal, like I was back in the military. It's a little medal with this little spinning toilet, which I thought was just the
funniest. Spinning toilet.
Yes.
That's
great.
With
a medal with a little spinning toilet. And I have it up in my office. But I actually have jars of wipes in my office that I've had there for years. I did a lecture on it a couple of years ago at a local water conference, and I had everyone take a jar, take a wipe, put water in it, and shake it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people I gave toilet paper, some people I gave, you know, quote unquote flushable wipes, and some got like a baby wipe, and they all kind of had to guess which one they had based on how it broke down.
Oh, wow.
And, so I have still a few of them in my office. They've been sitting in there probably 2 to 3 years still.
And it's just
look brand new
in there
because they're sealed, so they look brand new. And I'm thinking, this is, you know, once a month, I'll shake them.
Yeah,
nothing really changes.
Nothing, it's not going to break apart.
No. So it just shows that if they're there, they're going to stay there until we can get them out. So we're always on the lookout for ways to remove that. It'd be great to not have them in there to begin with.
Yeah.
So the more people we can educate, the better, because that way we can avoid those systems. But you know what it leads to. Those pump stations fail.
Uh-huh.
Now you have sewer overflows.
Right.
Pipes clog. Now you have backups in homes. I mean, there's nothing that good comes out.
And you've got a major... Then you've got... major infrastructure damage, and you got to spend money,
and it's the same, you know, people buying the wipes.
They're
going to have to spend the money,
right?
I mean,
yeah,
so it's great if you really need them and you need to buy them. We get that. Just don't put them in. Don't flush them.
Here's a trash can.
We had a Charleston Sanitary Board. The general manager there had a quote where he said, "Look, you know, yeah, you can flush a golf ball too, but we still don't recommend that." You know, and it's the same thing. You can flush it.
Yeah.
Literally, they can be flushed, but we don't want them to be
That's
flushed.
Not what we want
them, you know, out of the system.
Yeah.
You know? So it's been kind of fun. Everything, you know, if you rhyme, people remember it more. So that's the wipes
clog
pipe.
Pipes. Exactly.
And pumps, I always say, but you got to start with the pipes.
Yeah. It sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds better.
Yeah. Well, Janelle, I'm so glad we got to talk. I really haven't had many podcast episodes that kind of dug into leadership a little bit. I appreciate the perspective you brought on that, and women in leadership, and just being at the workplace and doing things differently, and all that. So I'm glad we got to meet and do this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast. I really appreciate it.
Words on Water.